Welcome to Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell, awakening the world to the power of God's Word. And now, here is your host, Dr. William Campbell.
Welcome to Beyond Words Radio, where it's our ambition to move beyond simply talking about Christianity and all of its teachings and doctrines to walking more like Christ. As we do this, though, we do need understanding, don't we? We need to have conversation around critical topics. And there's a world around us that, well, there are many who don't really believe there is a God, or if there is, that we can know him. And so we have a guest who really loves this kind of a conversation. His name is Dr. Michael Rota. He teaches philosophy at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota. He's got education at Stanford and in several places, up to his PhD at St. Louis University. And also out of Harvard, he's a postdoctoral. He's got involvement in a fellowship there. And I just want to thank you, Dr. Rota, for coming on. And I'd like to feature, if we could, your book, Taking Pascal's Wager.
Thanks, Dr. Campbell. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Yeah, you know, this idea of Pascal's wager is fascinating to me, and I think to anyone who learns what this is about if they don't already know. But before that, tell us, you know, how did you get interested in writing about this whole idea of how we can actually believe that there's a God and invest ourselves in this kind of faith? What got you moving this direction?
Sure. Well, largely interactions with my students. So I teach at a university. Some of my students are believers, believe in God. Some do not believe in God. Some are atheists. Mm-hmm. And some aren't sure, so they're agnostic. And every once in a while, I'll have a student come to my office who's interested in God and the topic of Christianity, but is not really sure if there's good evidence for it. So in that situation, I want to be able to, talk to the student, but also to give him a book. And there are some good books out there, some excellent books. I like C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity. There's a book by a philosopher named Richard Swinburne called Is There a God? So sometimes I would suggest those books. But in Lewis's Mere Christianity, he actually only gives one argument for the existence of God. It's the moral argument. And there are much stronger arguments out there, in my opinion. And then Swinburne's book is excellent, but it's a little bit dry, sort of academic, and not as accessible. So I wanted to write a book to give to a student in that situation.
So Blaise Pascal, he was, what, a French physicist? And why do we talk about Pascal's wager? Can you give us, Dr. Rota, a little background on that?
Sure. Well, let me tell you about Pascal himself. He was a fascinating individual. He died young. He died when he was only 39. But he's well known among mathematicians and physicists for contributions in those fields. If you ever learned about Pascal's triangle in mathematics class, it's the same guy. He was also an inventor. His father was a tax official for the French government and had to add up a lot of sums. So his son Blaise invented for him a calculating machine, which was one of the first precursors of the computer, and it worked with tiny little gears. He invented the syringe. He was behind the first public transit system in Europe, which was basically a bus system involving horses and very large carriages. So he's a very interesting person, but he was also deeply religious, and near the end of his life, he was drafting book-long argument in support of Christianity. He died before he finished, so his friends and family found the manuscript after he died, and it was published. It was lightly edited and published, just as a series of fragments. One of those fragments has a famous argument called Pascal's Wager.
Yeah, so the wager has to do with, it's kind of the things you talked about in the introduction. If someone's weighing the evidence and saying, yeah, maybe there's a God, maybe there's not, why does it really matter? What's the wager? Tell us.
Okay, so Pascal's wager was an argument in support of religious belief and religious practice. It was addressed to a skeptic or addressed to maybe a lukewarm Christian, someone on the fence, someone who wasn't fully committed. In a sentence, the argument is this: you should commit to a devout Christian life, because there's so much to gain and comparatively little to lose. So the idea is, look, if you commit to living a deeply religious life, and it turns out you're right and Christianity is true, huge values are at stake. So you've brought joy to God. You've maximized your chance at eternal happiness. You've probably been more of a help to others in their journey to God, which means you've been more of a help to others in the most important way possible. So if Christianity is true, it's very good that you committed to God. On the other hand, suppose you lived your life as a devout Christian, turned out there was no God, and you died, it all goes black. Well, Pascal argued, you haven't lost that much. You lost time, maybe a life focused on yourself, some illicit pleasures, but you've gained certain this-worldly benefits of religion. So, comparatively, and we can talk about those, but the argument says, much to gain, comparatively little to lose.
What do you say to a person who tells you that, hey, this wager is kind of interesting, but there are a lot of religions out there, and why should I just wager around Christianity? It doesn't make sense to me.
That's an excellent question. So, as I view the wager, I think it's best addressed only to a person who's already at a place where they can say, yeah, there's a decent chance Christianity is true. It's more likely true than any of the other religions. And, you know, I think it's at least as likely to be true as false. So if you get to a place where you're happy to say, hey, there's some pretty good arguments for Christianity, I'm not sure they're true, they're accurate, but it's at least as likely as not that they work. That's the person, I think, for whom the wager is most helpful.
Okay.
So it can take you from sort of agnosticism to, I've got a reason to really commit here. And then Pascal's idea is, once you do that, you'll be living a life in which you're more open to God's grace, and then God can help you come to faith. He can give you the gift of faith once you're living a godly life.
Okay, so I hope all of you are listening here as we dive into this topic. The idea being, if you already believe in God, this is going to strengthen your faith. If you don't, please think twice about not believing, because there's a wager you're making. You're actually making a choice not to believe. And we're going to give you some reasons why you probably should believe. In fact, there's a wager here, and you're going to benefit, I really believe, by this conversation. Let's dive into what we call the evidence in your book. Where did physical things come from? We know that there is an idea that, for example, the universe is just eternal. In fact, that was kind of believed, wasn't it, for millennia, even here in the Western world?
Yeah, Aristotle thought the universe was eternal. Well, there's a long tradition of arguments for the existence of God. It's a family of arguments. They're called cosmological arguments. Let me try to give a quick version of one. So, here's the basic idea. Suppose I come before you and I have an empty top hat, and I pull a rabbit out of it. And you say to me, that was amazing. How did you do that? Where did the rabbit come from? If I said to you, you know, I'm as surprised as you are. The rabbit just popped into existence and I pulled it out. If I said that, you wouldn't believe me, because physical things have causes. It's something we learn through our everyday experience. So the cosmological argument tries to move from that insight and then notes there are all these physical objects around us and tries to say, the best explanation for where all this stuff came from is from a non-physical object that has to exist. So, Dr. Campbell, if you'd like, I can sketch that argument in a little more detail.
Yeah, I mean, it would be good for us to think about this. I realize this is in the realm of philosophy, and a lot of us, we've kind of lost, I think, this idea of thinking. we as a society, we don't think as much as we used to, and you have a unique way of making things simple. So if you could help us see why it is important to see that physical doesn't just make physical, there's got to be a beginning point that's non-physical. Explain that to us.
Okay, well, we need some definition. So we need to define a contingent being and a necessary being. A contingent being is just a thing that exists, an object, but which didn't have to exist. So reality didn't have to include it in the way that 1 + 1 has to equal 2. Thus, you're a contingent being, so am I. My parents didn't have to meet. The tree outside my window is a contingent being. It could be destroyed, and then it would be absent from reality. In fact, all the physical things we know of are contingent beings. They can be destroyed. They don't absolutely have to exist in the way that 1 plus 1 has to equal 2. Now, we can imagine there could be another sort of being, a necessary being. And if there were a being like that, it would be something that exists and cannot not exist, something that has to exist. Reality had to include it. Well, what would a being like that be? The traditional conception of God is that God is a necessary being. He doesn't just happen to exist. He doesn't have a tenuous hold on his existence. He couldn't fall off a cliff and die. God in his divine nature has to exist. Okay, so the cosmological argument is an argument from contingent beings to the conclusion that there's got to be at least one necessary being. And very briefly, here's how the argument goes. We imagine all the contingent beings that have ever existed. So all the contingent beings that exist now in the whole universe and all the ones in the past. And we don't need to know how long that past was or how many contingent beings there are. It might have, as far as this argument goes, we can assume that there's been an infinite past or a finite past. But whether infinite or finite, we can consider all the contingent beings that ever existed. And then here's the next step in the argument. We ask, well, why is all that stuff here rather than none of it being here? Because we're talking about all the contingent things. So each one of those things didn't have to exist, and thus it could have been that reality didn't include any of them. So we could have had a world with none of this stuff, a reality with none of this stuff, or, as a matter of fact, all the stuff is here. And that suggests there's got to be some explanation for why all these contingent things have been here rather than not at all. But once we've said that, now we're going to have a good argument that there's got to be a necessary being. Because if there is a causal explanation of all these contingent beings, it can't just involve other contingent beings. If we said, why is all this stuff here? Oh, some other contingent being caused it all? Well, remember, we were thinking about the group of all the contingent beings. So if we said a contingent being were responsible for all the stuff we see, all the contingent beings, then we would be saying that that contingent being caused itself, which is impossible. So instead, we needed a different sort of being, a necessary being. And that's the argument that there's got to be some being very unlike all the things we have experience with that explains why all this stuff is here.
Okay, so some people are like, hey, this makes sense. Others are saying, you know what, let's move on to the next topic. Maybe it'll be more practical. And so Dr. Rhoda, thank you for that. And I want to ask you, we've heard this idea in a lot of places that there's something unique about our universe, especially the people here on planet Earth that are able to think outside themselves, to be creative, to connect with God, or at least believe there could be a God. This kind of life, this intelligent life, what are the possibilities, you know, of a universe that would create life like this? How could this have happened by chance?
It's a great question. And in thinking about the answer to that question, we can talk about one of the strongest arguments for the existence of God, called the fine-tuning argument. So that cosmological argument that we just talked about, mm-hmm. Our conclusion was pretty minimal. It was just that there's something which has to exist that's causally responsible for all the stuff around us. But we didn't prove that it was a personal being or had a mind. So the fine-tuning argument picks up where the cosmological argument leaves off. Here's the background. In the past 20 or 30 years or so, physicists and astronomers have discovered something that surprised them very much. And that's this. It turns out that our universe is just right to allow for life. It's like the Goldilocks universe. So there are a number of features of our universe such that if they'd even been a tiny bit different, then either you'd have no atoms or the universe would collapse upon itself 10,000 years after the Big Bang, or any of number of things would have happened which would never have allowed life to arise. I can say more about this if you'd like to get into the science a bit.
I think that, why don't we do this? Let's just talk briefly on probability. I know from things I've read that if we look at Pascal's wager, the idea of whether or not there is a supreme being that brought life into place on Earth, is very great. In fact, the probability that if we look at some of these scientific pieces of evidence based on modern understandings, the probability that there is no divine motive and instrument behind life is so slim. Give us a little sense of that, maybe picking one or two factors.
Yeah, the most impressive factor has to do with something called the cosmological constant.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a number. You have to go out and measure it. And it is related to the rate of expansion of space. The idea is that at the Big Bang, space itself started expanding rapidly. And at first it was very rapid, and then it started, the rate of expansion went down. So the Nobel Prize for Physics in 2011 went to two teams of researchers who were able to measure the rate of the expansion. And the figure called the cosmological constant encapsulates information about how fast space expands or accelerates or decelerates after the Big Bang. But here's the big point. It turns out that this number could have had a very large range between negative 1 and 1 if you use a certain sort of units called Planck units. And it further turns out that if the cosmological constant weren't almost exactly zero, you wouldn't be able to have life anywhere in the universe. If it were just a tiny bit bigger than zero, space would have expanded so rapidly that stars would never have formed. And without stars, you wouldn't have any elements higher than lithium. You just have hydrogen and helium and lithium in the universe. And hence, you'd have no chemistry, and you wouldn't be able to have the building blocks for life. On the other hand, if the cosmological constant were just a little bit less than zero, the universe would have collapsed within upon itself very soon after the Big Bang. So there'd be no time for life to arise. What's amazing to these scientists is the degree of fine-tuning. So having the cosmological constant be just right is like winning a lottery in which there are 10 to the 60th lottery tickets. So this is trillions and trillions and trillions of tickets, and we just happen to get the right one. So it's an amazing coincidence if there's no God in the picture.
I know authors have given analogies, and a common one is to look at a target on from one end of the universe, just a typical, you know, maybe a couple feet big. You're with a gun on the other end of the universe and shooting and hitting that target. I mean, it's just, we can't imagine what is the expanse of the universe, much less hitting a small target.
Yeah, it's an absolutely minuscule probability. So this becomes a powerful argument for the existence of God. Another option, so what an atheist will say sometimes when they look at this argument is, well, maybe our universe isn't the only universe. Maybe there are trillions and trillions of universes, and most of them are not life-permitting, but we just happen to be in one of the life-permitting ones. I mean, where else would we find ourselves? So that's a common reply to the fine-tuning argument.
Yeah, the multiverse. And what that requires, because there's no way to even test that one, it requires a stretch of faith. The very scientists who say to Christians, you use God to fill in all the gaps. You're not being scientific. That could be argued against, do you think, Dr. Rota, against this point of view that somehow we're just part of this thing that is out there. There are many, many universes all with their own laws, and you can't even begin to touch that with one iota of evidence.
Yes. Yeah, so I think this is a worthwhile point. The multiverse is not confirmed. It's not even clear that it is confirmable by empirical methods. So the scientist or the person who believes in a multiverse is really doing a little philosophy. And then we have to ask, what's the better explanation, God or the multiverse? And in the book, I give an argument that God is the better explanation. It gets technical, and whether or not we should talk about it on the program is up to you.
What I'd like to do, we just have a few minutes remaining, and I think that it would be really good to hit on some of the other points. And if you've just tuned in, we're talking about a book that's available to you. You can just Google it. It's called Taking Pascal's Wager. And its author, Dr. Michael Rota, is on the air with us, and we're looking through some of its salient points to help us understand that if you have to wager on whether there is or is not our God, you'd be pretty smart to say, I'm going to go with the idea that there is. And right now we're looking at some of the evidence, and then we're going to close it up with some final arguments. But the beauty and existential resonance of Christianity, tell us about that.
Sure. Well, in essence, the thought is this. If there is no God, and we're just a bunch of atoms who are here by chance, it's hard to think that there is an objective purpose to our lives. It's possible. Atheistic philosophers have tried to come up with explanations of how there can be meaning in a world like that, but it's very difficult. Whereas if Christianity is true, each of us, your life is a drama, so it has a goal. There's a purpose. God has a plan for you. There's a real sense in which your life has meaning. And that idea that our life has a meaning, that there's some reason we're here, is intuitively very natural. So that's a fundamental conviction that I often find myself with. It just seems like my life isn't meaningless. Christianity can explain that. Atheism is a very difficult time explaining that. That's the first idea from that chapter. Another idea from that chapter is this. The ethics of Jesus make a lot of sense. Christ says that there are two commandments on which all the rest hang. Love God with all your heart, and love your neighbor as yourself. And he says all the rest of the commandments depend on those. The ethical picture you get from Jesus' teaching has a certain ring of truth to it. So I think the ethical teaching of Christianity is an important piece of the evidence for its truth.
What we pick up is, if we can pick up your book, we're going to learn a lot more. But let's jump to the next part then, the counter evidence. And this is often called the problem of evil, but you title it Divine Hiddenness and Evil. Explain that to us.
Well, the problem of evil is the strongest, that rather the argument from evil is the strongest argument against God. But there's another strong argument against God that not everyone's heard about. It's called the argument from divine hiddenness. And so I talk about both those in the book. Here's how the argument from divine hiddenness goes. If God existed, then he would love us and want us to be in relationship with him. And if he wanted that, he would reveal himself. I mean, it's hard to be in a relationship with someone if you don't believe that he exists. So if God loved us, he would make himself undeniably obvious to everyone. But that hasn't happened. I mean, God's existence isn't as undeniable as the existence of the table in front of me. And so God must not exist. That's the argument from divine hiddenness.
And then we have the issue, don't we, of if God did that, where is our free choice? I mean, he wants us to love him, not to be kind of forced into belief. Is that kind of the answer?
I think that's exactly right. So Soren Kierkegaard, the Danish philosopher, gives an analogy relating to divine hiddenness. It goes like this. Imagine that there's a king. I guess this is set in the Middle Ages. Imagine there's a king, and he's traveling in his kingdom, and he sees from afar a beautiful peasant woman. And he hears about her and how virtuous she is and how intelligent, and he falls in love with her. So he wants to marry this peasant woman, but he's got a problem, because he knows that if he shows up in all his kingly splendor, it will be almost impossible for her to say no. So it will be difficult for her to freely choose to love him for the right reasons, having to do with his character and not his power. What can he do? Kierkegaard suggests, well, he could disguise himself. Not lie, but he could show up not dressed as the king, dressed as a common person, and try to get to know her in the ordinary way. He would take a risk, but he would be doing it for a great good, which is to give her the chance of freely choosing him for the right reasons. And the thought is that one of the reasons God doesn't make himself obvious to everyone is he wants to give us a chance to freely love him for the right sorts of reasons, having to do with the goodness of serving God and not having to do with the fact that God is powerful and can punish us or reward us.
Beautiful. It speaks to me. Can we talk about historical evidence? Some people want something as solid as a table I'm right now pounding on. They want something showing up in history to prove this Christianity thing is real.
Well, I think that's the great advantage Christianity has over so many other religions. There is strong historical evidence for its truth. My favorite single argument is the argument for the resurrection. Michael Lacona is a theologian, and Gary Habermas is a philosopher, have developed a particularly strong version of this argument. N.T. Wright has also contributed to this argument. So the basic, very old argument goes like this. The apostles claim they conversed with Jesus after he died. They claimed he rose from the dead. Either they were liars, or they were deceived. Maybe they were hallucinating, or they were telling the truth. But they didn't have the incentives to lie because they gained nothing from their proclamation of Christianity. On the contrary, they were persecuted. And they weren't deceived because this many sane people couldn't have group hallucinations. It's very unlikely. And therefore, it's most likely that they were telling the truth. But that's an old argument. But what recent scholars have done is have made it stronger by putting it on a stronger foundation. Here's what I mean. 19th century versions of that argument rested on claims from the Gospels about what the apostles experienced after the death of Jesus. But the Gospels have been, it's been argued by many people that they're not reliable. Well, maybe you can meet those arguments, but you might not have to show there's good reason to believe in the resurrection. What Lacona and Habermas try to do, they say, let's just look at the minimal facts that all the scholars agree on, the atheists, the agnostics, and the theists alike. What do they all agree on? They come up with three facts. Jesus died by crucifixion. The early disciples claimed to have experiences of Jesus after his death. That's two. And then three, Paul claimed to have an experience of Jesus after his death and subsequently converted to Christianity. So they just base their argument on those three facts, and then they say by far the best explanation of those three facts is that Christ really did rise from the dead. And when they're done with their argument, it's pretty strong.
So basically, the historical evidence around what Christ has done, around which we can argue our calendar's focus, this appearance of this person who claimed to be not just a good prophet, but God's son, who died and then rose again, that there is so much historical verification for it that it's hard to get around it, is what you're saying to us, right?
That's right. And what I'm trying to argue in the book is that given Pascal's wager, you don't even have to be certain about this argument for the resurrection. If you even get to the point where you say, you know what, that's a pretty good argument. It really does look like there's a good chance that Jesus rose from the dead. As long as you get there, then the considerations Pascal raised give you practical reason to commit to living a devout life. So in a way, Pascal's wager sort of lowers the bar for how much evidence you need.
Fantastic. Dr. Rota, thank you so much for your insights. I'd like to bring you on again next week, if you don't mind, because we've got more stuff to cover here. Is that going to work for you?
That sounds fine.
Okay.
Thanks, Kim.
Okay. Well, to our listeners, thank you for being with us. And we're going to take this a little bit further. And you feel free to email us if you've got questions, things you want covered. You can go to our website, scriptureawakening.com. And we'll see you next week.
This has been Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell. Beyond Words is a ministry of Scripture Awakening. And if you'd like to help support this ministry, or if you'd like to know more about Beyond Words, visit us on our website at scriptureawakening.com.